Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and he's an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Francine welcomes Dr. Lynn Wilson. Dr. Wilson is a professor, clinical director, and vice chairman of therapeutic radiology at Yale School of Medicine.
Can you tell us a little bit about radiation therapy and how it actually differs from our common thoughts of radioactivity?
Well, radiation therapy is something that's actually been used to treat cancer patients for nearly 100 years. And there are several different terms that really mean the same thing. Radiation therapy, radiation oncology, or the department here at Yale is referred to as therapeutic radiology. These really all mean the same thing. And radiation that typically we hear about on television or in the public media may refer to things at power plants or other unusual circumstances, but the kind of radiation therapy that we do in medicine is very well regulated and specifically targeted in most cases toward tumors or malignancies, although there are some situations where we actually use it to treat non-cancerous conditions, but it's very well focused. Treatment plans are very well designed. Things are very closely regulated. So it's much, much different when it's used in medicine compared to other non-medicinal applications.
Can you give us a little bit of history about the use of radiation therapy in medicine?
So X-rays were really discovered nearly a bit over 100 years ago. And things were fairly rudimentary in the beginning because we weren't able to really aim things in a very particular direction. We were just learning about it. So as things evolved over the years, technologies became more advanced. We started to use what's called a linear accelerator many, many years ago, and a linear accelerator is sort of what we know today as the standard form of applying radiation to cancer patients. And the linear accelerator is a device which accelerates an electron at very high speeds down a short course that interacts with a target which produces a photon or an X-ray, and that X-ray comes out of the machine and can strike a tumor within a patient. And in terms of the size of that X-ray or its how energetic it is or how deep it goes into the patient can all be decided and regulated by the physician.
So the kind of machines that you're using for radiation therapy are very different than X-ray machines.
Very different. You know, an X-ray machine basically sends an X-ray out and goes through a patient, and on the other side of the patient is the target, and it can capture that image. That would be a diagnostic type of X-ray. And all of the radiation that I or anyone in our department here at Yale use, or anyone who's doing radiation oncology, would be used for a therapeutic purpose as opposed to a diagnostic purpose.
So there are a number of different ways that radiation therapy is used, and I understand there are also radioactive elements that we actually give to patients. Could you talk a little bit about the types of radiation therapy?
Sure. There are really three major types. And external radiation, which we call teletherapy, is the kind of treatment that would come from that linear accelerator, where a patient is on a table and the beam or X-ray or photon, as we call it, comes out of the machine and strikes the tumor within the patient. That's the majority of the type of radiation that's used to treat cancer patients. There's another form of treatment referred to as brachytherapy, which is the use of radioactive sources, which can come in several different forms. They can be very small seeds, in the case of where we might do a prostate cancer implant, for example. And brachytherapy refers to the application of radioactive sources very close to the tumor or next to or implanting the tumor. A third form of therapy is where we can actually give a systemic or an agent which can go completely around the patient's body, perhaps in the blood circulation, and there are radioactive isotopes that are attached to antibodies that seek out certain malignant cells in the body, and so that's a systemic form of radiotherapy. But the most common form that we use is that from the linear accelerator.
Now, we also use radiation elements in diagnostic testing as well, in common diagnostic testing thyroid cancer treatment, as well as even MAGA scans that we do to look at the heart function.
Right. So that's a bit different. And those are radioisotopes, though, and they are targeted to certain tissues. In the case of thyroid cancer, there are really a couple different things. You can have a diagnostic scan, which may show us the activity that's going on in a particular thyroid tumor, where it's lighting up, for example, as it appears on a scan. And then there can be therapeutic uses in thyroid cancer of radiation as well. But the primary type of radiotherapy we use is teletherapy, or it's commonly referred to as external beam. That could also be used in the thyroid, for example. So we have these different choices that we can use. And it can be rather complicated, but that's why the residency training program is rigorous and fairly lengthy, because there's a lot to learn and there are a lot of different applications and a lot of different choices.
So what kind of cancers do you use radiation therapy for?
Well, almost all of them. And there are some that are a little more radio responsive than other types, but really all cancerous cells will be responsive to radiation. Some are exquisitely responsive to radiation, and we would use just radiation alone, for example, in the treatment of a patient with a certain type of problem. Other malignancies can be better treated by a combination of radiation with systemic agents or chemotherapies, for example. And so the answer is really most or nearly all malignancies will be sensitive to radiation. The question is, are they sensitive enough for us to use just radiation alone, or do we need to combine that with another systemic or chemotherapy agent to really have a better chance of curing the patient?
Is radiation therapy used at the beginning as a first therapy for cancers, or is it used later on, or both?
Really both. Sometimes it's used as an initial or first therapy, and then that would be followed by chemotherapy. Today, since we've really moved toward personalized cancer therapy, where we're really trying to target that patient or that type of cell directly with very, very specialized treatment programs, and this really falls into the area of selected chemotherapies, we often combine radiation and chemotherapy together for the best results. And then there's some situations where we might give chemotherapy first in a patient with lymphoma, for example, many of your patients, and then we might follow that with radiation, which we would refer to as consolidative treatment. And the doses can be different. Sometimes we use a very high dose when it's used initially, but there's some disorders where we use radiation alone and the doses are very low. So it really depends on the cell type, the clinical situation, and that's what makes this so complicated. So the answer to your question is really all three, before, together, and perhaps after.
And in fact, if you go really far back in time, one of the first cancers that was really cured with radiation therapy was Hodgkin's disease.
Right.
And even today, radiation therapy is a main part of the therapy for many lymphomas.
That's right. And that's changed a bit. And it's changed as the systemic therapies have become more advanced, new developments, better targeting. Also, we're better today at making the diagnosis, learning more where these diseases might be harbored inside the patient's body. So systemic therapy and radiation have both come a long way over the last 40 to 50 years.
We've heard the term radiation sensitizer when we talk about certain kinds of chemotherapy drugs. Could you talk a bit about that whole concept of radiation sensitizer and how often you employ that in your treatment of patients?
So, for example, in head and neck cancer, there's some early stage head and neck cancers that are very, very well treated with radiation alone. The tumors are very responsive, and it's not necessary to really add anything to help that radiation do its job. But in more advanced head and neck cancers, for example, we can use relatively high doses of radiation to solve the problem. But when we get to certain dose levels, we begin to get into a problem where the side effects of the treatment become fairly significant. And so we, over many years, have introduced radiosensitizing drugs that really make these cells a bit more sensitive to the radiation, so that we can still use high doses of radiation, but don't need to push so hard that patients get such bad side effects from the radiation that the treatment essentially becomes worse than the disease. And so these drugs, what's nice about them, cisplatin, for example, not only has activity by itself against the cancer cells, but also has radiosensitizing properties and can do things to those cancer cells that make them more sensitive to radiation than they would be without the exposure to a drug like cisplatin. And that's just one example. There are many.
So this touches on an important point and something that we talk about oftentimes on the show, which is the multimodality approach for many cancers. So it sounds like, you know, with solid tumors in particular, we have a surgeon, We have a radiation therapist and a medical oncologist. Could you talk a little bit about that multidisciplinary approach and how it applies to radiation oncology?
The multimodality or multidisciplinary concept is really, really important for the patient, and that's for several reasons. One, typically here at Yale, for example, a patient can come and be seen by multiple specialists in one visit. For example, in our practice, you may see the patient in the morning, and then I'll be seeing the patient immediately afterwards, and we may have the patient see a surgeon after that. So it's really one visit for the patient, and that helps with logistics. The other advantage is all of the physicians or specialists that are involved will typically meet perhaps later that day at the end of the day regarding the patients that have all been seen in this multidisciplinary consultation. We review all of the pathology, all of the x-rays together, and we're literally all together in the same room going over each patient's case. So it really provides a high level of carefully coordinated care for the patient so that everything is well understood, we can reach a consensus, and it's really excellent for the patient. Now, in a setting where that's not available, certainly a patient could see a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist, and a surgeon, but the visits may be spread out over several weeks. Those physicians may not even work in the same building as each other, so that can always cause some challenges in communication, and often that works well, but there's really no way to get a better substitute than to be able to see all of the physicians in one visit, and those physicians are actually working with each other, working together on that patient's particular case that day, and having access all to the same information in real time.
These multidisciplinary clinics have really only come about over the last 4 or 5 years. Prior to that, we really weren't thinking in these terms when we treated patients with cancer. So can you talk a little bit about how the multimodality approach applies, say, after a patient is treated, moving forward in the follow-up? Do you still see those patients?
Yeah, we do. And that's very important because as we've had more experience under our belt, so to speak, on having patients as cancer survivors and doing better and having better clinical outcomes, patients are always at risk for a couple of things. One, long-term side effects from treatment. So we see them frequently and observe them for conditions that may come up that are related to the treatment so that we can intervene rapidly to try to help with any problems or counsel the patient regarding these issues. And of course, there's also the issue. Patients are doing better. More patients are being cured first time around from their cancer. And with some malignancies, patients are at risk to not only have that malignancy come back again, so we have to monitor them closely, but also may be at risk for a second cancer. That may come up. A head and neck cancer patient, for example, is at increased risk for lung cancer, typically if they've had a smoking history. And so we evaluate these patients in the follow-up as part of a multidisciplinary program as well. They don't always have to be seen by all the physicians, and we're sensitive to not having a patient have inappropriate or unnecessary doctor appointments, but we all follow the patients very closely, and they're often seen in these multidisciplinary settings. And if there is a problem or there's something new that's diagnosed, the value of this is that we have all the consultants together so that we can put our heads together immediately for that patient without delay.
Okay. Lynn, can you talk a little bit from a patient's point of view about the logistics? Say a patient sees you and needs to get radiation therapy, what happens next?
So there are a couple of options for that. If it's someone who has an emergent problem, for example, there's bleeding from a tumor, or they're very uncomfortable because of pain, or they're having a breathing problem from lung cancer, in that situation, I would be called to see the patient. We would see the patient, and we would see the patient immediately and start treatment very urgently that day. That's one scenario. That's fairly unusual, though, but we're prepared to manage that for the patient if it happens. What typically happens is we see a patient in consultation. They'll see other specialists regarding the problem, typically that day in our multidisciplinary program here at Yale. We would formulate a treatment plan that day among the physicians for the patient. This would then be communicated to the patient from one or more of those physicians. And with respect to radiation therapy, we would then plan to have the patient come in for what's called a simulation. That might happen the next day or several days later, and we take the patient's logistics into account as well. We want to try to give them appointments that work best for them. During the simulation process, that's really where the design of the radiation treatment begins. And In our program, that patient gets a specialized CAT scan, although it's an easy CAT scan because they generally don't need to swallow any material or get an intravenous injection, but sometimes we do that. And we use those images from that scan to carefully plan their radiation treatment, which will then begin within 1 to several days later as coordinated depending on what the multidisciplinary plan is.
Thank you, Lynn. I'd like to talk a little bit more in detail about some of the long-term effects of radiation when we come back from the break. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we're discussing radiation oncology with Dr. Lynn Wilson.
There are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing cancer treatment is very exciting, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. After treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships can be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by Dr. Lynn Wilson, Professor of Therapeutic Radiology at the Yale School of Medicine. Lynn, we talked a little bit about the logistics of radiation therapy with the simulation and the treatment planning. Can you tell us a little bit about the long-term complications and the immediate complications of patients who are undergoing radiation therapy?
Certainly, and that's really critical to a successful treatment program is managing those complications. There's not one set of side effects or complications that would happen for any one patient with any kind of malignancy. It really depends on what part of the body the problem's in, sometimes the age of the patient and what they can tolerate, what we call their performance status, how well they're doing before we start treatment. But some of the very common side effects of radiation that we see in all patients are some level of fatigue, although usually that's relatively minor. If we're treating something in the head or brain area, we can see hair loss. Usually with any type of radiation that's from external beam, we'll see some irritation of the skin, not typically a sunburn type of effect, but some irritation and perhaps dryness of the skin. There's some treatments that we do, though. For example, gamma knife treatment, which is a very, very specialized treatment that we've had at Yale for many, many years that we use to treat brain tumors or metastatic lesions in the brain. That technology is developed in such a way that treatment is given very quickly and with extremely minimal side effects and often even without any hair loss. If we're treating a problem in the lung, sometimes patients can get an irritated or sore throat or trouble swallowing. Again, we spent a lot of time, Francine, in trying to design and customize these treatment programs for each patient so that we can avoid these side effects to a greatest extent possible. Many years ago, when we didn't have the kind of technology that we have now, and we didn't have at Yale because it wasn't available at any centers, we would set up beams and aim them at tumors, but it was very, very difficult for us to avoid very critical structures such as the heart or the esophagus. And that example you brought up of Hodgkin's disease many years ago when radiation alone was used to treat Hodgkin's disease, it was a very successful program, but the radiation fields were very large and came with quite a bit of toxicity. And now we can avoid that. But there can be gastrointestinal side effects in some cases, depending on how much intestine or bowel is in the field. But these are things we try to take into account. But most patients actually do very, very well and can have a very, very minimal side effect profile. Those are the kinds of things that might happen during the treatment course. Longer term, sometimes patients can develop scar tissue. But again, we try to counteract that by deciding on what sort of fractionation schedule or how often should the patient come for treatment. If we give very large doses of radiation over a very short time, just a couple of days, that patient's at slightly increased risk for long-term complications of scarring, to give one example, or fibrosis, or a complication in the bowel. Whereas if we gave treatment to the same area, but spread it out over many visits, say a month, 5 weeks, the chance of having a longer-term complication is really, really minimized. And these are sort of general recommendations. but these hold true. So that gets us to the reason of how long it takes to give radiation, and that's one of the main reasons that many of the fractionation courses are quite long and spread out over many weeks, 7 to 8 weeks, for example, 9 weeks in some of the lymphoma treatment that you and I work with when we use total skin electron beam. I could give enough radiation in several days to probably manage the problem, but this long-term side effect profile would be much higher.
Lynn, that gets to an important point that I wanted to touch on, which is the technology that's involved in radiation therapy. I've been down to your department and I've been very impressed, obviously, by the big machines, but also by the tremendous amount of computer work and time that goes into planning these treatments. It's a very complicated procedure.
It's extremely complicated. 20, 25 years ago, we had these linear accelerators, so we had really good technology, but much of it was more driven by human beings. It wasn't nearly as computerized. Still to this day, we have radiation therapists who are staff who are right on site with the patient at the linear accelerator at all times. We have several of those staff members present at all of our linear accelerators, but things have really become really technically advanced in the age of electronics, and this is good for two reasons. One, we're able to deliver radiation more precisely than we ever have been before, actually through the use of onboard imaging. And on our linear accelerators, we actually have the ability to do what's called a cone beam CT scan as part of the treatment program, and that helps us delineate that the treatment field is going exactly where we want it to and to really document. Now we're starting to take tumor motion into account, but there's a tremendous amount of computer and electronic capability and technology behind these treatments, but the staff member, the actual human being, is also essential to everything going very, very well.
And I've also heard about the use of PET imaging and other ways of actually imaging tumors so that you can more precisely delineate the tumor. Is this going to be a part of the future in terms of radiation therapy, you know, using these kinds of labels or tags to really precisely isolate the tumor cells?
Well, not only is it going to be a big part of the future, but we use it now. And to pick another example, for lung cancer, every patient that we evaluate at Yale who has lung cancer will be getting a PET scan. They've either had one before we meet with them, or if not, we get it both for diagnostic purposes, and it's absolutely essential in the treatment planning of their care because we don't want just anatomic definition. We also want metabolic information. How active is that tumor? Sometimes the metabolic information from a PET scan, for example, will give us additional information that's useful in treatment planning compared to just a static CT scan image. And also as part of imaging, every patient that would get lung cancer treatment at Yale will have what's called a four-dimensional CAT scan, and that's a special CAT scan that actually takes the motion of the tumor into account, and that's important because if we've got a lung tumor, everyone's breathing, that tumor is going to move. It may move a little bit in some patients. It may move quite a bit, several centimeters or an inch or two in other patients, and we need to take that motion into account. We're not interested in just setting up a radiation field that's sort of big enough to just account for the motion, as might have been the case many years ago before we had these kinds of technologies. But now we take that into account. And again, it gives us another advantage in being able to very, very precisely target these tumors and account for that motion every single day while the patient's undergoing treatment.
Well, Lynn, sitting here as a person who does chemotherapy as a medical oncologist, I feel as though what I'm doing is fairly primitive because I inject a drug into a patient and I'm not exactly sure where that drug is going to go. It sounds like you have a much better handle on being able to target tumors effectively with radiation therapy.
Well, we've done really, really well in terms of the targeting, both in terms of how we devise the treatment plans. IMRT, for example, is a technique which has been available at Yale since the mid to late 90s, where we use many, many radiation beams that all converge on a single target. Often motion isn't so much involved with that problem, but it's, again, a way to deliver treatment that's in a highly precise manner so that we can really avoid side effects. When we're treating a head and neck cancer patient, for example, we'd like to avoid the side effect of a dry mouth. That may not sound like it's such a problem, but it's really, really a major side effect in the treatment of head and neck cancer. And with the use of IMRT, we can often completely avoid that problem because we can exclude the parotid gland, the gland that makes our saliva. There are two of them, and we can avoid them, or at least one of them, as part of our treatment program. Even as recently as in the mid-90s, we couldn't do that. So those parotid glands would get treated as part of the therapeutic package, and that really added to patient side effects. But we're able to target better, we can deliver treatment more carefully and with more definition, we can take tumor motion into account, which we weren't able to do years ago. 4D CT is a relatively new technology. We've had it at Yale and have been using it daily for several years now. And then, of course, bringing up your point about the PET scanning, bringing that into the armamentarium. And I'm not talking about just having a PET scan that we look at on a computer and say, there's the problem, I kind of know where it is. We actually take the PET scan information electronically loaded into our computers and superimpose those images over that four-dimensional CT scan and plan for that patient as an entire package. So that's the level of detail that we use when we're planning these cases for patients.
Can you talk a little bit about research and your particular research interests?
So we are certainly well recognized as one of the most well-funded from the NIH research programs in radiation oncology in the United States and have been for many years. So there's several kinds of research that go on in our department. There's basic or laboratory research that's happening that doesn't involve patients, where our scientists are trying to make new discoveries relating to perhaps radiation sensitizers, types of cell lines that can respond to different kinds of radiation in new sorts of ways, and all sorts of basic laboratory research that's happening. Another major form of research that's happening in the department is clinical research, where patients are part of clinical trials or clinical investigations, or we're trying to answer questions by looking at patients that we've treated over many years and studying their results. And we have a variety of clinical trials that are involved in the use that include the use of radiation, many of them chemotherapy as well, that are available to patients right now.
And I know that, Lynn, you are one of a very few number of radiation therapists in the country who does a specialized kind of treatment called total skin electron beam radiation, and that's specifically for patients with a rare disease, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, that I also study. Could you comment a little bit about that specialty?
Sure. So total skin electron beam therapy is extremely complicated. It's one of the most complicated treatments that we do in all of radiation oncology. The reason it's complicated is because you can imagine all of our skin folds and the nooks and crannies, how do we really get a good dose of radiation that's relatively as equal as possible to every spot around the body and do that in a way that's not toxic for the patient or doesn't cause other problems for them internally? So this is why it's complicated. We're one of the busiest centers literally in the world. Many patients, as you know, come to see you and I from other states, sometimes other countries. And the Total Skin program has been in place for over 30 years. At Yale. The technology was initially developed at Stanford University and then quickly adopted here shortly thereafter. We've treated many, many patients with this technology. Every day we have patients at Yale receiving total skin electron beam therapy. And so we really have a dedicated program with therapists that know a lot about this particular kind of treatment, physicists who are involved in calibration of the machine, doing certain measurements for each patient. And so that's a highly, highly specialized kind of radiation that's not given actually at many centers. All centers are capable of doing it, but it's so technically complicated, there are actually only probably a handful of even academic centers in the United States that have enough expertise in this to have the kind of volume where they would even do more than 10 cases a year. We do many more than that.
And this is a treatment that actually can be curative for these patients as well. Can you talk a little bit about your success
with
this disease?
So there are many different forms of the disease, as you know, and there are different kinds of skin lymphoma. Radiation treatment is a highly successful treatment for these patients. All of these patients respond to radiation. It's a matter of who's going to have a complete response. And this gets to the point of how we combine therapies. Often we'll do radiation treatment, but sometimes that will be followed with a systemic agent or given concomitantly with a systemic agent, or we'll follow it with another kind of therapy to maintain remission or cancer control for the patient. But the patients do very, very well with this treatment. Certainly, the patients with earlier stage disease do better than patients with more advanced disease. But even those with very advanced disease, with tumors on the skin or involvement of their blood with the disease, there's a role for total skin electron beam therapy in certain patients. So since this treatment is so successful for these folks that have and have often suffered for this problem for many years, that's one of the reasons that we're a big referral center for this disease.
Lynn, I'd like to just say one thing about that, and that is that a lot of times people don't really appreciate the value of this kind of treatment, even if it's palliative, even if the patient has a recurrence of their disease. These patients are so symptomatic, and they get better so quickly with total skin radiation therapy. I think it's a very valuable part of our treatment and approach for these patients.
Oh, I agree. And again, what's nice about our program is that the treatment is literally skin deep, or perhaps touches some of the tissues just below the skin surface. So patients do not get an upset stomach, they don't get breathing problems, and in fact, they get minimal fatigue, very low-level fatigue, if they even get it. So patients can drive, go about their social and professional routines, and the treatment is very, very safe. And in fact, we don't even worry about any bone marrow toxicity or effects on the blood counts. We get one blood count at the beginning of therapy so that we have it documented, and we don't have any troubles. So it's well-tolerated and an excellent palliative treatment.
Well, thank you very much, Lynn. This has been a really fascinating discussion about radiation therapy. You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Lynn Wilson, for joining me this evening. From the Yale Cancer Center, this is Francine Foss wishing you a safe and happy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.